Hi, this is Ron Jeffries. You're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Elia, and I'm speaking today with Kyle Arate. Kyle is co-founder of TechEdge Training, and we'll be speaking about Diamond Agile. Now, if you prefer video, there's an extended edition of this conversation on YouTube. Go to the Agile Uprising YouTube channel. We'll have a link in the show notes. But Kyle, why don't you introduce yourself, and then we'll get into the topic of Diamond Agile.
I've been in software forever. I've been doing code off and on since the early 80s. In 2000, I discovered extreme programming, and I've been an extreme programming devotee ever since. Taught some extreme programming classes in 2000, 2001, and then the whole world forgot about extreme programming and discovered process-centric agile. Mm-hmm. And I've been kind of annoyed about it ever since.
I like that. So we have a similar background, except I kind of went down the evil path of management, and I kind of have been for a while. You stayed in it. You stayed very technical, and we've had some really good conversations.
Yeah.
So Diamond Agile, as I understand it, it's not necessarily a framework. It's a way that, how you've languaged it to me, is it's for framing the problems of Agile, the things that we're just not hearing talked about with things we do call frameworks or methods in the Agile universe.
It's more, look, there's all of these things we've learned in 20 years. You've been around for 20 years. I've been around for 20 years. I talked to anybody else who was in Agile before the manifesto got signed. Anybody who was in there before, we know there's parts to Agile that weren't talked about for 10 years. And so there's this idea, the notion, and I've said it in other presentations, hey, you know what Agile is? And everybody goes, yeah, that's kind of like Scrum, right? And the question is, how much of Agile is Scrum? And I start from Scrum is probably a solid 5% of what Agile is.
Yeah, but you hear people talking about it. And it's one of the things that kind of, I like to say, woke me from my slumber, because I had done one of my handful of times I've had my own company. When I went down a road of having my own company, Scrum was one of the things.
Yeah.
When I came back out from that, it was almost like it was the thing.
It was the thing. And these days, it looks like people are starting to be aware that Scrum isn't the only thing in the Agile constellation. And you go out and you look, and there's Scrum has its stuff, or you can look at Kanban and Nyberg stuff, or you can look at Safe, or you can look at Gene Kim and his DevOps stuff, or right.
I like to call it DevSecCeteraOps. Right?
Yeah.
But now you've written some books on Scrum yourself, right?
Yeah, so I've got.
We're not bashing Scrum here, even though I'm guilty of doing that.
So it took me 15 years to get over the fact that Scrum wasn't XP. But after 15 years, there's some things Scrum does really, really well. Mm-hmm. And I want to appreciate things. I have a theory that says, if you are going to talk about something, first talk about what it's good at. And then we can talk about quibbles. But until you have, what's your mother say? If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
I just got removed from the cast of podcasters. When you first started telling me about Diamond Agile, you were using the word facet a lot, because there are a lot of facets of Agile. So that's kind of where it seemed like this thing came from. Go ahead and say more.
What we were just saying, I started in XP. Mm-hmm. I thought in XP in 2000, that Agile was a technical practice. When you stand up during the day, or when you have meetings, or how often you do a retrospective, that's not what Agile is about. Agile was about how you write code differently under conditions of uncertainty.
Right.
That's what Agile was about in 2000.
I was doing Spiral before Scrum.
Yeah.
I loved it. And at first it was a big sales job of, hey, I don't know where we're going, but why don't we pick something in a very short horizon and deliver something that works and see if that actually solves the problem before we go 9 more months into the future.
Absolutely. And so I grew up with Agile as tech. And then Scrum talks about Agile as mostly a process. And if you read the manifesto, they say almost nothing about tech in the manifesto, even though they were all hardcore techies.
Right.
And they start the manifesto by saying, this isn't a process. Right?
Right.
People and interactions over processes and tools, right?
Yeah, and so, there have been times where we try to cross out in the community, we try to cross out the software bits and try to make it more generic. And to be sure, Agile is valuable in other contexts. I was talking with procurement at my current company today, and they're embracing Kanban, Agile.
Well, and so that, again, I think that comes down to trying to make sure we understand the problem we're facing, rather than just treating Agile as a solution without defining what it's a solution to. And so my big thing in Diamond is, let's define the problem. Let's look at the facets of the problem, the facets of what a solution might look like. And then we can talk about what pieces are necessary to solve the problems that you have at your business.
Cool. So go ahead then and let's start describing the problem.
Okay. So we all know the Standish Chaos Report, right? Chaos Report. We read the Chaos Report in the late 90s. We read the Chaos Report I read it for 2015 recently, found a version of it. And you know what it says? It says, one, things haven't changed much. Two, people are doing Agile, but they're not really being allowed to do Agile for real, so you're not seeing any big changes. Mm-hmm. The numbers are still what we see on the screen here. 1 in 6 projects is a success, roughly what we wanted, not very much over budget, not very much late, right? Plus or minus 20%, I think, are their numbers. And that's 1 in 6 projects. That seems like a shockingly bad number.
Right.
Until you realize that you've never met a project manager who isn't cheating.
That's
right.
That's true.
We're always taking money from project A, which we already know is going to fail, and putting it on project B. We're having purple work on project A when they're not funded for it.
Or we're hiding some effort that, you know, there's some padding in there somewhere. You can't see it. You flip the Gantt chart around and look at the utilization. And it looks smooth, looks good. There's hiding.
There's a lot of hiding. That 15% is not 15%. It's 15% after we've lied about the numbers. And you know what? Most IT executives aren't any better than the project managers when it comes to giving this clear and unvarnished truth. So I got 15% project success, 16% 1 in 6, after 2 levels of massaging the numbers.
Right.
That's the nice words for that. Then I have much larger numbers. Check a Standish report, check it out. Another 1 in 3 projects, 1 in 6 projects, get to what you wanted, but cost on average 90% extra on time and budget.
Mm-hmm.
Another third of projects don't get what you wanted, but we eventually deploy it and it costs 90% extra.
Mm-hmm.
And another third of projects, we just don't get the project, but it still costs 90% extra on average.
Okay.
Right? So we're talking about numbers that are absurd. If this were anywhere else, you'd use the word train wreck. but this is normal state of affairs in IT, and it has been for 40 years.
And agile or not really hasn't changed. What I'd like to think we're doing in the agile universe is trying to change the conversation.
So what Standish report is pretty clear, the 2015 Standish report says, look, we're not seeing a lot of different numbers. Smaller projects in Agile are doing better, but really people aren't being allowed to actually do Agile. And so these benefits you're supposed to get from Agile, we're not really doing Agile. The corporate choices are constraining us into not doing any of the things Agile tells us we have to do.
Right.
And so we're not seeing the results.
Let's take a look at some of these other aspects.
Okay. So the problem is, roughly, we have 40 years where no IT projects succeed, right? 15% is massively exaggerated. So we're talking over 90% failure rates in terms of, here's what I want, here's what I'm willing to pay for it. No, that just doesn't happen. 1 in 10, if we're lucky, probably 1 in 20. That's the real state of IT success. And if you're not starting there, then maybe you think we can make small changes and get away with it. I've been watching the industry since the 80s, and this is pretty accurate. IT projects don't succeed, and if they're bigger, they don't succeed harder. Right? That's the truth of this. And so this is why we're doing Agile. It's because all IT projects have massive problems. And sometimes we can successfully pretend that the problems were only moderately large. And sometimes we can't pretend that.
We're going to hear the retort, and I know it. I've heard it a bunch myself when trying to defend Agile, is, well, you're talking about Agile done wrong. But I agree with your numbers. And this is also when I criticize something, for example, like Scrum, it's because it's done wrong most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's the case, we're missing something to keep us
on
better than 50% chance of having a good outcome.
Well, so I like to say the things that we're missing are, people walk in with Scrum as a solution, and I would like to be really loud about what is the problem we're solving. Good. Every time I get in place with an executive who's making decisions, I'm saying, here is the problem we're solving. Here are techniques we're using to solve the problem. Scrum is a technique. If you want to take out stand-up, what you're going to do is you're going to have less coordination on a daily basis on your team. The techniques we have are tools to solve part of our problem. And everybody says, oh, Scrum is a thing, but I don't want to do this part. And nobody's talking about the cost benefit on each one of the parts. Or at least I'm not hearing anybody else talk about it. Right? When you go out,
there's still a lot of legacy speak, right? So in the larger environments, I think we're still project funding.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
We're still in a situation where if you wanted to cancel a particular contract with a vendor that you have received approval for funding, if you cancel that contract, the money goes back to the ether. It doesn't stay with you.
Absolutely. So
you think would be smarter.
I'm not here to say there's clean, easy solutions.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm here to say is 5% IT projects succeed at a 5% rate, more or less. If you are willing to go do normal things and continue to succeed at the 5% we're already succeeding at, I don't really have much to say. I can't actually help.
Well, so let's continue to find the problem then, because I get where you're coming from.
So my line is, the problem comes from problem complexity. Historically, in the Agile world, everybody likes to talk about the Kinefin framework for complexity. I'm not a huge fan of the Kinefin framework, but that's because I have a math background, and I think Kinefin isn't taking, I think they're trying to simplify complexity too much. And so.
Okay. I mean, it breaks the problem space up into four quadrants. And
yeah.
Okay.
And I got 10 sections of complexity that we can talk about. I do it from a mathematical point of view. Some problems are predictable.
Okay.
I break those into easy problems like 2 + 2, hard problems, 2-digit × 5-digit multiplication number.
Okay.
Polynomial problems. Polynomial problems are problems that you can compute how long the solution will take, even if it takes a while.
Well, I'm glancing ahead to your slide, and you're bringing back my AI master's degree work now. We're going to head into what used to be problems that we couldn't solve in real time.
Well, I mean,
that's changing.
So it's not that we can't solve them. It's that easy, hard, and polynomial have predictable solutions.
Right.
But then that's three categories of problems. And I like to call out that we have known in standard conversation in complexity theory, 6 additional levels of complexity in the unpredictable space, in problems that we don't know how hard or long the solution is. NP complete problems are problems where every possible solution can be computed how long it will take to check the solution, but you have to check them all.
Right. So right? Traveling salesman used to be one of the problems back in school, right?
Shortest path.
How do you conserve your time and gas money to get to all your clients in a day?
Yeah. How do you minimize the distance you travel in a day is great. The problem is if you have 100 cities, there's something like 100 factorial solutions, which is a 150, 200 digit number. And we can check the length of each one of them, but there is no way to figure out what the best one is except by checking them.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, it's become easier to do with distributed computing, but it's still a.
But I mean, what's the line?
Right.
Some of these problems are every computer on Earth at its current speed until the heat death of the universe kinds of calculation.
Are you taking a dig at my Bitcoin mining? No, I'm not Bitcoin mining. I've never done it. Okay. So got it. So that's NP
complete. That's the unpredictable one level of unpredictability. And we have lots of levels of unpredictability.
Right.
Some problems. Say, do the traveling salesman problem, but now deal with changing traffic in different cities per time of day, week, and now it's an entirely different problem,
right,
which is harder than the one we started with, which is already unpredictable.
Right.
It's worse if you're trying to solve a problem like that and somebody else is also trying to solve the problem better than you do. And now we're not dealing with simply the world. We're dealing with an opponent.
So I'm looking at your slide and I'm trying to be conscious that we have a podcast going. I love that you said trying to win at poker against good opponents. I would throw out there winning at bad opponents. I do a weekly poker game. And when there's a new somebody at the table who doesn't know how to play, it throws your whole game off because
they
could do anything.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Everybody else you're playing around the table is trying to win. This person, I don't know what they're trying to do.
They're trying to throw money in and have fun and the whole, yeah.
So that trying to predict what the other person's going to do. My wife loves The Princess Bride, another 20-ish years ago.
Yeah.
And there's the intellectual guy, and he's having the debate over which glass of wine was poisoned, and he's back and forth.
Inconceivable.
Right. So that's the same kind of problem you're describing.
Absolutely. Here. And it's a level of problem. It's not just a changing problem. It's a problem with an opponent.
Right.
Where probably it's changing too. And then you move into the next level of discussion, which are complex adaptive systems.
Okay.
I use the example of changing lanes in traffic, right? What lane you're in right now is probably going slower, and there's a mathematical proof of that. But then you are trying to shift into other lanes because the other lanes are currently going faster, but that's going to change as other people see the same things and shift as well.
Right.
And so the current moment in time tells you one thing, but then everything takes that into account, produces the next moment in time, which is a step forward. Initial mm-hmm. conditions are enormous, and trying to keep up with, there's a field of study called complex adaptive systems. Now,
that's a good example of one. I like
it. And that's great. And we're not even to the hard problems yet. The really hard problems, the military uses the acronym VUCA at times, V-U-C-A, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. Things change quickly. We don't know what's really going on. There's complex adaptive systems already, and we don't have enough information.
What did you call this? VUCA?
VUCA. It's an acronym that is military from the mid-80s, I think.
Okay.
And it's volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity.
It reminds me of Bohica, but I think it means something different. I'm going to save that
yes.
for the listening audience to look up on their own. And then the last one you've got here.
There's a further category of problems which are called wicked problems. VUCA problems are nice in that they're incredibly hard and we don't have enough information, but mm-hmm. at least we understand and agree on the problem. Wicked problems are first characterized by a failure to agree on what the problem is.
Right.
Hey, let's make Iraq better after the invasion.
So this
What do you mean by better?
This is, well, maybe your last two at least, or maybe your last three levels of distinction map to the chaotic in Kenevan.
Yes, but so here's the problem. Okay, so which level is trying to improve your market share under if you're a bank and you're trying to improve your market share? If that's not CAS or VUCA, I'll eat my hat.
Mm-hmm.
My claim is if they're calling those chaotic.
I don't think it's wicked, but I do think it's one of those.
Right? I mean, we know what the problem is.
Right.
Right. I understand the problem. The wicked problem of it is, hey, let's build the best mobile app for our business. Yeah, so what would the best mobile app for our business be? How could you tell? How would the, when you do one mobile app, it changes the market, and so now your original other choices are no longer available? There's a whole bunch of features of
right.
wicked problems, but the I don't know what the problem is, and I can't tell if it's working until after I've solved it, are interesting features, and building the right app may well fall into that category. So
yep.
I think that maybe they would call those chaotic, but those are the problems we really have. And so when I talk about the problem, I'm saying, look, we are only in this world dealing with unpredictable problems. The ability to predict ends with polynomial problems. Anything after that, we are basically unable to predict results. We are guessing.
So I spent a stint of time working for a company that wrote software for the quick service restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And there were formulas for how long it should take to clean the store, how long it should take mm-hmm. to make a particular meal. Quick service restaurant, you're judged on getting these things out the door in minutes, right? Because that's why people are coming to you. So I would say those are hard problems by your category. They're multiplication
problems. Yeah. They're multiplication problems. Do these six steps in a row with predefined ingredients in a predefined order. I have a 15-step sequence that I have to do. But if I practice for a while, I can get it right at 99.9% accuracy.
Right, right. And if you're not getting it right, something's wrong with training at that store. That's a good indicator. Maybe we need to do some training. But you can know, you can be pretty accurate.
Yeah.
You have a system that allows you to be pretty predictable.
Yes. But that's because you're doing the same thing again.
But this was not us writing software. Us writing software was in the unpredictable category. The software problems we were helping to solve were in the hard category.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Most of the time when we write software, if it bears writing, it probably hasn't been done quite exactly that way before.
Right.
Otherwise, you could buy it or lease it.
Right? Yes. And so it is roughly true that every piece of software being written is unpredictable.
Right.
It is unpredictable. And I'm going to push on this. It is unpredictable in principle.
Yep.
Not just in practice.
Yep.
We cannot theorize a method that would give you good predictions up front of software that is long software. And yeah, I spend a bunch of time on estimation theory, and this is roughly the position.
and listen, and I, there are some people I absolutely love in this industry. I've gone out to participate with Steve McCormick, who's a big estimation guy. Troy McGinnis does a lot
McCormick or McConnell? McConnell.
Did I say McCormick? I probably just mentioned somebody I work with right now.
McConnell. Or Spices or something, but... Yeah, McConnell's, I love McConnell. He's like one of my favorite researchers ever.
Right. And then McGinnis does a lot of good work with Monte Carlo estimation techniques.
Love it. I'm a giant Doug Hubbard fan. How to Measure Anything guy book.
But even with these techniques, we're still making the assertion that we're in the unpredictable realm.
Yeah, I mean, McConnell's famous for the cone of uncertainty stuff. Mm-hmm. At initial estimation, at project charter time, you got plus or minus 400% is what you're expecting. If anybody would take that seriously, I'd be a lot happier. But somehow people don't think, it'll take sometime between a day and a month is a reasonable estimate. But that's what the cone of uncertainty tells you is your actual range of knowledge at project charter time.
Right. We learn more as we go. If we're doing agile,
we learn more faster.
We should accept these as facts in the beginning. And as we learn, we should start to zoom in on what is valuable and should we continue to gain funding and tackle the problem, or have we learned enough to say, this isn't where we should put our money.
Absolutely. And so all software projects fail, and they mostly fail because it is impossible in theory to predict what's going to happen with a software project. We're trying to solve a new problem, and solving the new problem, we discover stuff along the way that can make it two or three or five times harder of a problem. So, if we buy this position,
right,
that is the world Agile was built to deal with. This is the world that you and I were in the 90s, where we're going, how the heck do we deal with real existential uncertainty?
And this is where extreme programming, spiral model, and Scrum was around. Honestly, it wasn't the most popular thing in the mid-80s.
Well, but did you read the paper? I mean, I read both the 96 paper and the 2002 book.
The new software development game? The one from Japan?
That was the 86 paper. The 96 paper was Schwaber and Sutherland.
Right. 95 Oopsla conference.
Yeah, yeah. Like 95, 96. They talk about the problems we're talking about. They didn't actually explain Scrum as a solution in the paper. Hmm. They used the word Scrum, but the actual Scrum we know, that was defined in 2002 in the book, right? The rainbow book. So this is the problem we were dealing with. And so Agile was a solution, fundamentally, the fact that software projects failed most of the time. And even when you had a bunch of superhero developers, software projects fail most of the time. And so what can we do about it? And Agile was an attempt to say, what can you do about the level at which software projects fail? And a lot of that is just uncertainty. And so we looked, and honestly, we came up with the same solutions that the people in the military have for how do you deal with heavy duty levels of uncertainty. The people in manufacturing, how do you deal with heavy duty levels of uncertainty? If the kind of work you're dealing with is unpredictable, there is a well-known approach. Everybody who's ever studied operating in unpredictable conditions gets the same results. You build a small team. You prioritize aggressively the work that you're doing. You make your decisions not from your plan, but off of feedback systems.
Right.
You work small units, not one big unit. You work 10 small units, one at a time, most important first. You spend time making sure your people are really good at the basic tasks they need to do so that those tasks become automatic.
Right.
And at high levels of uncertainty, you can't measure the success of one thing and count it as, oh, this is how we're measuring success. Success measurement is statistical and long-term. Everybody who's looked at this problem knows all of those things. Okay. Military for 100 years has been looking at this stuff. Manufacturing's been doing it for 50. We in software have been doing it for 30. And we all say the same things, but small team, aggressive prioritization, feedback, small units. Improve your skills. Measure when statistical variance isn't going to make up fake numbers for your measurement.
Yeah, I like this. I was talking with somebody about manufacturing world. Could have been today. Could have been just the other day. And one of the things about the manufacturing world, it's why there's, I think, ahead of us in the lean universe, is the forms of waste in manufacturing show up on the floor, or they show up in the warehouse. In software, they're really hard to see if you're not technical.
And to some extent, they are trying to normalize solutions so that their solutions, they are trying to optimize their production process rather than solve a different problem every single time they show up to work.
Contract manufacturers, though, my father-in-law was a contract manufacturer, and he may move some equipment around to do a particular job.
Yeah.
Right. But the kind of jobs that he was willing to say yes to depended on the skills of his team and the equipment that he had, or the equipment he thought he could get, and the inventory and supplies he thought he could get in a reasonable amount of time.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, it was off limits and he had to say no and refer a friend, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So my claim is, we all know this basic solution set, and I've been saying it this way rather than by saying the manifesto. The manifesto says very similar things. Look, build a team, prioritize work, make feedback decisions, work in small units. Those are all standard behavior. I think sometimes in Agile, we forget how important building good habits and reflexes are, and making measurements across the long term rather than the short term.
Right.
Because the short term is dominated by uncertainty and statistical variance, right? That's Deming's number one line. And I mean, if you really believe that we're having enormous failure rates, mostly due to built-in unpredictability, this is your basic answer, right? That's what we got.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what can we do? Well, Agile says, you know what? Let's summarize. If you've got unpredictability, then how responsive you are is what matters. Can you move quickly and easily without misstep? Right?
Cool. Yep.
So again, not too much separate, but now we're moving towards what I'm actually here for. Agile, Diamond Agile. The thing about Agile is, if you really want to deal with the small teams and the feedback driven, there's lots of aspects to a solution that you have to address. And I'm just going to list the ones around. I have the top view of an octagonal diamond here on my visual. There is Agile in the center, and around it is process, people, tech, product, enterprise, change, scaling, and mindset. If you're going to do Agile in a large organization, you have to address all of these.
So you have 8 facets of Agile.
I do.
And in a large situation, you said, now go ahead and go through each of these 8 facets. Let's do that.
Okay. So I'm not going to go through the last slides. They're not very good slides. They're not very pretty slides anyway.
Yeah, let me just talk for our listeners. We'll just have a conversation, and we have the diamond.
Yeah. And I'll send you this deck if you want it.
Yeah, that'd be great. Now, somewhere. These eight aspects are, again, process, people, tech, product, enterprise, change, scaling, and mindset.
Yeah.
Do you start anywhere in particular?
Is there any process?
They're all just considerations. No necessary starting point.
No necessary starting point for sure, but I'll tell you, everybody starts with process.
That's the easy one.
Well, it's the one that everybody hears about. 90% of people talking Agile think Agile means Scrum.
Right.
And so everybody starts in Agile by doing the process piece of Agile. And the process piece of Agile is you do a stand-up every morning. You do a sprint review at the end of every 2 weeks. You do
the process piece of Scrum.
80% of Scrum is the process piece of it.
Yeah, no. I was just defending that if I'm doing Kanban, I may not be doing those ceremonies.
And so if you're doing Scrum, you do that. If you're doing Kanban, you're a process improvement method.
Right.
And you're making the work visible, and you are working in small units, and you're respecting the existing process. And we're taking the Kanban pieces seriously.
Right. And DevOps, we have the three ways. And very similar, but got it.
Here are the steps you do roughly on a cyclical fashion. The cycle time varies a little bit. Nobody's doing month cycles anymore. The question is it a 1 week cycle? Is it a 2 week cycle? Is it a 3 week cycle?
You're saying nobody's doing monthly cycles anymore.
I meant to say nobody's doing 3 month cycles anymore.
3 month.
Right? And most of the people doing Scrum are tired of Scrum's 30-day cycle.
Now, to be authentic, so people who've heard me on the podcast before know I will beat up Scaled Agile Framework or any of the large frameworks, which is the enterprise, I think, piece of your facet of the diamond here. But when you're in an enterprise that's been around over 100 years, where I am today,
you got to deal with it, man.
You do have to deal with the fact that there are cycles of 6 months, 9 months.
Yeah.
It's real. We have mainframe code that is wicked problem to rewrite.
Yeah.
I'm looking for the word.
I don't even understand the problem well enough to figure out what a rewrite would look like.
Right. Is it even practical to do that? What's the strategy for contending with this thing?
Yeah.
And a lot of our applications at the end of the day, if you're talking about moving money in a way that's sound, the mainframe's in play.
Yeah,
you're talking about a mobile app to help you understand all your accounts and your financial situation. Those are microservices around the mainframe.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're simpler.
Yep.
Right? I completely in play.
I think to say it correctly, nobody would start a new endeavor thinking about a 1 month, 3 month type of horizon. But
an existing
enterprise, it could have that and worse.
So yeah, so you don't start new enterprises. So here's the deal. Agile says the problem we're solving is deep uncertainty. Mm-hmm. I have massive unpredictability that leads to huge failure. If you have massive unpredictability that leads to huge failure, we know that one of the few things that can lead to better successes is feedback systems in shorter cycle times. And so you're absolutely right. The mainframe should have a 3, 6, 9 month cycle time. And it's also true that by having that 3, 6, 9 month cycle time, your failure rate's going to go up a lot compared to what it would be if you had a 2 week cycle time. The fact that you've chosen a 6 or 9 month cycle time because you had to means that you're not being able to course correct at the level that you would be able to course correct at shorter cycle times.
I agree with that. I would tell you that when we're talking about changing something fundamental like the general ledger, the 9 months may be more about it is vital not to make a mistake.
Oh, absolutely.
So the change seems simple. I mean, I've had conversations with people at the enterprise that say, man, I really just thought I was asking for this kind of thing. It took 9 months and $250,000 to pull it off. It's of the consequences of getting it wrong.
Okay, so then we start to go, okay, so I don't want to have that argument right now. I would love to play in that space with you at some point.
No, cool. I got this. I'm
but
thinking,
you're right.
Nobody does it anymore. You wouldn't start there.
You don't start there. The fact is, the higher your uncertainty, the shorter the cycle time you want in order to check things.
Agreed.
Right?
Yep.
And the more you're able to run short cycles, the better your feedback, the better the results. My favorite result from Steve McConnell, who you mentioned earlier, was he studied software projects for years and says, okay, I got one feature that predicts software success best. How early was your first working prototype?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's just a brilliant thing. And we all know that. Basically, are you building the right product? Can we show it to customers and check it and confirm that we're building the right thing fast? That's the number one thing that makes a project succeed.
Yeah. See, I think I just was talking about what would be more of a polynomial problem.
Yes. And so if you don't have a hard problem, don't do this.
It's that we needed to be damn sure we did it right.
Yeah. So we're not solving the hard problem. We've already dealt with the problem. We know what we're going to do. Now we just have to do 27 or 2,700 known steps.
That's right.
Great.
And
that's not the problem that Agile was built to solve.
You're right. Yep. Okay, so that's process. I over-indexed on process.
I love process.
That's me.
So here's the thing. What's line one? Sorry, it's line two because the preamble counts. What's line two of the Agile Manifesto?
God, you're quizzing
individuals.
And interactions over processes and tools.
Everybody starts Agile as a process. And the first line that anybody reads on the Agile Manifesto is, process isn't the important stuff.
Right. We have to talk about what over means.
Over means these things are nice, those things are more important.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, we're doing this, these things are more important piece. Process Agile is something you do. It's a useful, important thing, but getting the human factors, the people and the teams working in Agile is far more important than getting your process right. Everybody who signed the initial manifesto said, look, the people side of this is more important than the process side.
Right.
Getting your stand up, happening daily is less important than making a good team. And a lot of folks starting off just don't understand how deep the people side of Agile goes. Agile is fundamentally a way for human beings to have a better way of working together. It is a way of getting teams to own responsibility rather than managers assigning responsibility to individuals. It is about human factors, better place to work. It is about making teams into real teams as opposed to small groups who may know each other.
Who may work in the same physical proximity.
Or not.
Right? No change. But yeah. Okay.
Fundamentally, the people side of Agile is acknowledged by everybody who's been in coaching for a length of time as more important than the process side of it. It's pretty much universal. Find 105+ year coaches. 98 of them say people's more important than process.
No doubt.
Gosh. So talking about the stand-up, that's nice, but that's not where we go in Agile. More interestingly, it's not where we go once you get rolling. To start Agile, we almost always try and get a cadence going. You set up Kanban or you set up Scrum. But once Kanban or Scrum is set up after the first 30, 60, 90 days, it's all people all of the time. It's trying to make the human factors work. It's trying to make safety as a prerequisite. It's trying to get the team working together and respect and honesty and Scrum values and those things. Right. That's where we go. Right. And honestly, from about 90 days in to about 365 days in, that's probably the most important part of Agile, is actually getting a working team. Sure. Problem is, and you know this, but most people in Agile don't, once you've got a working team, you then have a timer going and your software is going to start falling apart. Because Agile says, let's not do traditional phases. Let's not do a big, deep analysis phase. Let's not do a big, deep design phase.
Right.
We don't do these things.
We just don't go off on paper for a long period of time without some feedback confirmation.
Well, but I'm sure you've seen it. If people start doing Scrum and we don't spend some active work on how you do design in a Scrum world, then the design pieces get skipped. The analysis pieces get skipped. The testing pieces get skipped. The documentation pieces get skipped, right? The question of how do you do good software behavior? How do you do good software practices when I don't have a month to do design? That's an entirely different question.
Well, now you're slipping into tech.
Now we're talking about the technical side of Agile. Once you get through the first, I don't know, 6 to 12 months, the most important thing sitting in front of you is getting the technical pieces of Agile right. How are you doing development different? How are you doing deployment different?
Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm an expert in facilitating these things, but test-driven development, mob programming, these kinds of things.
That's home
in the category
for me.
Of tech, right?
Yeah, and that's what I do for a living most of the time is talk technical Agile.
Mm-hmm.
And the diamond mostly came out of trying to distinguish between the process Agile stuff that everybody talks about, the people Agile stuff that everybody
says they value.
the coaches all seem to actually value it.
Yeah, I agree. good coaches. Not every Scrum Master who just went out and became a Scrum Master necessarily understands that yet. But
anybody who's been in for 5 years gets this.
Anybody who's been coaching, Scrum Mastering, practicing Kanban, whatever, for more than 5 years would agree.
Yeah, that's my line.
But the technical stuff doesn't necessarily make it to people with that level of experience.
No, but that's because, I mean, the original founders of Agile, look at the people who signed the manifesto.
Oh, I was reading their stuff before the word Agile came around.
Yeah, all of them were tech weenies.
Yep.
Right? Yep. I mean, Schwaber and Sutherland maybe not, but agreed. The other 15 out of 17 or whatever it is.
Kent Beck, Ron Jeffries, Bob Martin. I'm not leaving anybody out in particular, but those are people I was reading. Alistair Coburn.
The pragmatic programmer guys, Hunt and Thomas, right? Yep. All of them are deep.
Who doesn't want to even talk about Agile anymore? His last talk is about slamming Agile, which I love, by the way.
And I'm good with that. The problem is the technical side of Agile is where it started. And Sutherland keeps saying, so now we're up to 16 out of 17. This stuff doesn't work past a year or two if you don't get the tech parts in play.
Agree.
Right? This is words that everybody who touches Agile needs to hear. Agile.
And you and I are also very passionate about Agile for software. It's not that it can't be used somewhere else.
Well, so let me switch it. Fine, if we're doing this in military, first you get the process and the cyclical behavior in play. Then you spend 18 months building a team to make sure they can function.
Breaking down the individual, bringing up the team.
And then the other thing you spend your energy on is getting the reflexive, habitual behaviors down. How do you shoot a gun? There's no thinking. You're not allowed to think. You just do it this way.
Okay, so those are your equivalent technical practices.
There are technical practices. And you know what? In Lean, in Toyota production, it's the same thing. Here is how you move this wrench. Here is where you hang it. Here is how you hang it. Here is your hand motion.
Okay,
Everybody who does this has technical practices for how to do this skill, not how do you do this skill on a day-by-day basis. How do you do this skill on a second-by-second, minute-by-minute basis?
Right. Okay.
Right?
Yep.
There are technical practices and they exist in the technical side of Agile, but they exist in any other domain that's taken this seriously enough to know what small, fast, one-piece flow looks like.
So fourth aspect is product.
Product. You want to build Google or Yahoo? In software, the only thing that matters is what product you build. Everything else is fluff. Are you building the right product or are you building a wrong product? In software, not in Agile, in software, the right product is the whole answer.
Okay, so when you say product, it's discovering what, you know, confirming that the problem and the solution you've got are suitable.
Are the correct problem and
correct
solution.
Correct problem and a good solution to that problem.
And honestly, most of Agile says, oh, we will assign somebody a role called product owner and we'll pretend they can solve all of these problems.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I slam Scrum, but I'm not going to keep saying that. Okay, go.
Well, but I mean, go look at it. Menlo does their solution anthropologist. ThoughtWorks has voice of the business and voice of the customer.
Right.
VOC. Pivotal has a product manager, part-time product owner, part Scrum mastery role. Pick somebody in the industry. There are no two leaders in the industry who use the same understanding of product ownership. When I do this, I've done some calculations and I say, you know, a product owner, if they're going to do the job that everybody kind of expects a product owner to do without enumerating it, it's probably 20 years of post high school education.
And it's a team.
Right?
It's honestly a team if you do it well. But
product owner is a team job. Historically said there's the Agile, there's the team doing delivery and there's the team doing discovery.
Yep.
And there's an entire job. And so Lean Startup and Art of Business Value and go pick your favorite thing. The product side of Agile, figuring out what the right product is. I want to go further than this. The number one reason software projects fail is you build the wrong product. You build a product that the customer doesn't want. The customer changes their mind.
The market window, this gets back to small teams, small chunks of work, because
and fast,
you could have gotten feedback. You could have delivered some value.
Yeah.
An experiment on, hey, if you like this, you'll like the next three things. You'll probably like the next three things, but we let's make sure you like this first.
Yes. And so doing feedback systems at the get small bits to the customer, figure out what they actually want, and don't assume that my project notion is correct up front.
Yep.
Starting from the my project theory is probably wrong, let's figure it out, is a huge step. It is probably the giant step in Agile, where you're saying, I'm not here to build the product I'm planning to build. I'm here to start building and discover what we really need. My favorite line is, build the product the customer wants and needs instead of the one they asked for.
Got it. Okay, so that's the product space, and it's not just product owner a la Scrum. But
there's an enormous product discovery process. Lean Startup or Steve Blank is probably where you start here.
Knowing what to deliver
is the hardest problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's Enterprise Agile. Agile says we're going to build off of teams, right? So how stable are your teams? How much of your compensation comes from how well you work in your team instead of how well you work individually? How do you get promoted?
The two biggest problems I see in big enterprises are how the projects are funded and how the individuals are rewarded.
Project funding, it's overall incentive structure. There's some stuff around compliance as well, where we have internal compliance rules that don't match the formal rules from external. But yeah, it's incentives in lots of ways, mostly from funding and HR is where enterprise comes down. I am convinced, by the way, it took me forever to realize this, that the single smartest thing being done by Leffingwell and his buddies is they have gotten senior leadership involved in doing agile pieces at the enterprise level. Whether or not I agree with what things they're doing, getting senior leadership to participate in agile activity is probably the single smartest thing they've done.
I agree. I've relaxed my criticism of SAFe now on my second organization that's really seriously giving it a go. And this time I think it was kind of necessary. My hope is that we use it to see the tangled dependencies that we have in the organization, to see that perhaps we're trying to take on too much work at the same time and do something about how we're structured.
So that
one day maybe we don't need SAFe.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to separate enterprise and scaling as separate things too, right?
Oh, enterprise. Okay. You do have those as two different aspects of the diamond, two different facets, enterprise and scaling. Got it.
And so the enterprise piece is, hey, what rules do you have in your organization that may be conflicting with Agile? Agile is deeply team-centric. So we build stable teams and we assign responsibility to teams and we reward teams and, right? That's what Agile says. And nobody in traditional enterprise does that. So
A little bit of work. Jürgen Apello has some ideas for team rewards that are pretty cool.
There's huge things to be. I'm sure there are people doing this.
Yeah.
I am convinced that something like the daily stand-up, a weekly touch point in our ceremony book, we call it a heartbeat ceremony. Mm-hmm. A weekly heartbeat ceremony for executives, moving them in the direction of responsive agile decisions as opposed to deep plan decisions is probably the single biggest missing factor in most transformations. Getting executives doing some agile stuff. And I can critique SAFe, but I told you already, I'm here to talk about what things are good at, not what I don't like about them.
Yeah, and we're describing the problem and aspects of the problem that we need to be present to and not step over.
Yeah.
So distinguish before we get off the enterprise, distinguish enterprise from scaling, which is two facets down. And if we're clockwise.
So the problem is enterprise change and scaling are all related.
Yeah.
So scaling, here's the deal with scaling, and I'm jumping over change. Scaling is what happens if you have an agile work that is more than one team of work.
Right.
Agile is built for a team to do work.
Jeff Bezos says two pizza team, right? And I think we've spread
two pizza team is great.
Yeah.
We used to say 15. The number 15 is dead several years ago. People talk about a dozen as a top team size, or 10, or even 8.
I think in our particular enterprise, SunTrust, right now, we're trying to limit it to 11, and we're having a hard time.
Yeah.
7 plus or minus 2 has always been my favorite.
Yeah. So, again, you check different people. I've read people for years. 10 years ago, people used the number 15.
Yeah, okay.
The number has dropped over time, just like the ideal cycle time has dropped.
Right. That's true.
Small teams are better.
Right.
Right? So the question is, what happens if you need 30 people to solve a project? What do you do? Mm-hmm. And so we have an entire swarm of methods built trying to solve the how do you solve large projects. Right. Interestingly, I think SAFe is mostly a scaling framework, not an enterprise framework.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's less large-scale Scrum.
And now there's Scrum at scale. There's Scrum Nexus. Scale.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. These are all scaling
frameworks. How do you handle multi-teams?
Yeah.
The fact is, you do some trade-offs. You give up some of your agility in order to do more coordination.
Yeah.
Every single one of them says, here's the amount of agility you should be giving up in order to do more coordination. SAFe says you should give up a lot of agility in order to do more coordination. Less says, no, you shouldn't. You should give up less agility for coordination.
That's clever. But, I like that.
But really, that's their whole dispute is how much is the trade-off of coordination between teams versus how much do we want the agile responsiveness thing? And that's a decision. I'm a tremendously responsiveness guy. That's where I live. I'm mostly like what the Nexus folks have to say, which is, hey, when you're talking about scaling agile, you're talking about managing your dependencies. Right. Why don't we reduce the dependencies instead?
Ideally, yes.
That's the long-term target.
I agree.
If you want to do something in the meantime while loudly proclaiming our long-term target is this and we'll take this step along the way, I'm good with that.
This is what I actually have come around to. The scaling frameworks have value when you're taking an organization that has really embraced Taylorism and has really gone down the path of functional specialization, and you want to bring it to small cross-functional self-empowered teams.
Yeah.
Right? Without a lot of dependencies. So we jumped over change, like no organization ever does that, but we just did.
Oh yeah, nobody does that. So change management. The fact is, agile is an organizational change. Organizational change efforts have similar success rates to projects.
Oh, I would imagine they're worse.
Well, I mean, I'm already betting 95% failure rate for software projects, so I'm not pushing on too much worse.
Okay.
Organizational change is this enormous problem that, as far as I can tell, nobody in Agile talks about for real.
There's some good people.
Talk about org change as a real thing.
Yeah.
I once spent a while taking a hard look at organizational change, year and a half.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of stuff out there. If you want to do pop org change, just pick up a Cotter book. John Cotter's stuff is fine. It's pop org change, but it at least says, look, you got to pay attention to organizational change.
Right.
if you want to go deeper, Warner Burke is the Harvard PhD professor who talks about it, and he's got books on the topic, and they're very expensive, but they're good books on how to do org change. And if you want to go to harder, faster, more agile models, maybe you want to take a look at appreciative inquiry, right? There's some serious work on organizational change and how you get organizations to change as opposed to, hey, we're going to do this team agile today. And it needs to be about 100 times louder in the agile world than it is today. Right?
Got it.
Go read Cooper Ryder and Appreciative Inquiry and come back and talk about other stuff after that. But that's really where I want to sit. The change effort is as large. Anytime I'm running an agile transformation, I'm talking about how we're doing messaging. Who is sending out messages? Can I get the CIO to send out a newsletter every week, which we write, which we help to write, which we nudge him in directions? How do we get enough information? How do we get leadership from the front to happen?
You are actually consulting for a company that just got named Inc. Number One.
Swan Leap, absolutely.
And so are you doing what you just said there? Is that you are working with the CEO of the company to send messaging out?
We are doing messaging. We spent most of our time, honestly, we spent 6 months mostly focused on the people side and the mindset side of Agile, with some work on process, a little bit on DevOps, a little bit better analysis of our product stuff. And so, yeah, we're going through this whole bucket of stuff at Swan Leap.
Very cool. And I'm going to put the Inc. Magazine link in the show notes, but Swan Leap. So you're able to get, you're getting top-down messaging about this transformation work.
Oh, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Right? I mean, we're a fast-growing small tech company.
And okay, you just said small tech company. So one of the challenges I've seen in the large enterprises, you know, our organization is 24,000 employees, but we have just as many contractors working with us.
Yeah.
The messaging can come from the top, but there are a lot of layers that the message has to penetrate.
So change management, it talks about this.
Right.
It is easy to get the ground level folks doing some stuff. Mm-hmm. It is moderately easy to get senior folks, C-level suite, doing some stuff.
Right.
Getting directors and middle management and VPs doing stuff, that's impossible. Right?
And I can tell you from firsthand experience, being middle management, coming in with these agile notions and not... you know,
yeah,
being treated like I'm a flower child from the 60s is a challenge as well.
Most change efforts fail by people smiling and nodding and not doing anything. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the question of how to make that work is an interesting question. Again, I think that getting the senior executives doing agile activity with their subordinates and getting trickle down agile is the best single answer I am familiar with.
Nope, I got it. And then, so there's one more, and it's actually one of the things that I hear people say a lot is agile is not a process. It is a mindset.
Mindset. Absolutely.
So, but what the heck does that mean?
So the fact is, what we're really trying to do in Agile is we're trying to shift how we approach problems. We are trying to get you to think differently. When you get a new problem, I want you to approach the problem from an Agile approach. Teams, prioritization, feedback systems, small units of work. I don't really want you to approach it from a, hey, Bob should do this work. How fast can he get it done if we don't let him go home tonight? Right? Right? That's not how you want to approach agile problems. Also, I don't want you to approach problems of, oh, we have a new problem. Let's spend 6 months planning it. No, that's not the right answer.
Right.
Agile has a fundamental set of stances. I want to argue that it's team priority feedback, small work units, long-term approach, supporting the team, building a skills for a long-term team. That's what we do in Agile. And when you encounter a new problem, if you've got an Agile mindset, you approach it with that lens. If you've got a non-Agile mindset, then maybe you're going to plan, schedule, manage, and incentivize this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The concern is people wave around Agile as a mindset so much that they don't take seriously. Mindsets take time to grow. You don't get an Agile mindset by thinking about Agile twice. You get an Agile mindset by doing Agile for 5 or 10 years. And the whole time, your understanding of Agile deepens.
Yeah. No, I get into trouble. I've said this and received some backlash. It's been so long since I've done a Gantt chart that I think I've forgotten how to do it.
Yeah.
But it is true. I mean, when you're living in this space of, I don't know if every problem I try to solve is wicked, but it's definitely not simple.
Right. You're beyond predictable problems.
I don't even want to talk
about work life. Yeah. They bore me.
I want to do something valuable and I want to build on that.
Yeah.
Or I want to learn that. Nope. I was wrong. It's not valuable. Good.
Yep.
What else should we be doing? Oh, should we not be doing anything at all in this area? Or are we just barking up on a tree? That's
this whole project was a bad idea. Let's stop.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And so Shuhari, which everybody knows about, or my favorite article in all of education is an article about Andre Agassi learning to see the tennis court differently than anybody else on the planet. I don't know where it was. I read it 5 years ago, but it's just brilliant in terms of the business of when you are a 10,000 hours chess master. If somebody practices chess for long enough, they become a chess master. You can show them a chessboard mid-game for 1 second, knock over all of the pieces, and they can place the pieces back where they were.
Right.
Because they have learned to see chess games differently than anybody else. And a normal human being can't do that. Enough practice and you see the world differently. Agile as a mindset is what we're chasing. But the way you do it is you do Agile for a very long time and it slowly seeps into who you are, into the way you see the world. It's not just what you do. It's when you look at the world, you see Agile features instead of seeing projects.
So Kyle, we talked about Diamond Agile, which is your way of really framing the problem of Agile.
Yeah.
From 8 different facets.
Yeah.
Kind of went through all those, talked about the problem space, a little bit more fine grained than Kinevin. Hey, for me, nothing wrong with Kinevin. It's like a, you know,
it's
if there's
fine.
Just 4
it's,
quadrants, here's where you go. You just got even more detailed on that.
It's I have the math background and
right.
It was too simple to say, no, I don't think you're taking how deeply complex these systems are, right? What I'm calling complex or unpredictable, they'll call chaotic some of the time.
I got you. There's something to learn from all of these conversations, and this was a good conversation. I want to be able to direct our listeners or our viewers your way if they want to continue the conversation. So email address.
Karetae at techedgetraining.com.
Cool. And on LinkedIn, Kyle Arete. Good conversation. We could go on about this and you and I have. I think said, hey, what are you doing? Let's have a quick conversation. And 3 hours later,
yeah,
we're still talking. But this has been a great conversation. Yeah. I have a feeling you're going to continue to refine Diamond Agile. So
Yeah, for sure.
Have another conversation a year from now. I don't think it's going anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
As you sharpen the message of getting people to think about these facets.
Yeah, it's agile. It's facets and purpose. A year ago, I was trying to call this purposeful agile. Agile exists to solve the we fail most of our projects, and we fail because it's unpredictable. What can we do to mitigate that circumstance given why it's happening?
Mm-hmm.
And we have an answer, and we have different parts of the answer, and I just don't want folks to forget that the answer has parts.
Thanks to our guest, Kyle, and to our listening audience. If you liked this episode and you're consuming it from the podcast territory, subscribe to future episodes from iTunes or Stitcher or the podcast platform of choice. While you're there, give us a review. It really helps others to find us. If you're doing this on YouTube, hey, we'd like to have a review there as well. And help us understand how we can provide you more value. If you'd like to discuss this episode or spark up a conversation about it, we have agileuprising.com, and we're also on Twitter at Agile Uprising. So one final note, we do accept donations or pledges through Patreon. We at the Agile Uprising just kind of chip in some money to keep things going. If you want to help us out, it'd be cool. If you don't, that's cool too. But it's Patreon, patreon.com/agileuprising. And we'll put all the notes up on the website, podcast.agileuprising.com. So until next time, this is the Agile Uprising signing out.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Kyle.